Welcome to the 11KPW podcast, Remedies and Enforcement by Jonathan Swift, QC. This talk was given at the 11KPW General Data Protection Conference on the 13th of October 2016. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kpw.com.
Right, good afternoon, everyone. Remedies and Enforcement, what better place to start after lunch? Here is a bullet point overview of the provisions in the GDPR that touch on remedies and enforcement. So there is a supervisory authority. There is going to be a European Data Protection Board. There are provisions on representation of data subjects when they're exercising their rights of enforcement. Complaints to supervisory authorities, judicial remedies against supervisory authorities. Administrative fines, compensation, penalties, there you have it. Overall, a sort of similar bunch to the sort of provisions that we are familiar with from the directive. And here, just to prove that, are those familiar directive provisions, although not in full. So under the directive, we have a supervisory authority, and we're going to have that in the post-GDPR world as well. The EU Working Party, under the new scheme, that is going to be rebranded and reborn as the European Data Protection Board. There we have reference to judicial remedies, to other sanctions, the right to compensation for damage arising from unlawful processing. We've got all these things already. But what is different, and I suppose perhaps specifically what is characteristic of the GDPR? Well, here's my attempt at characteristics in three words. Prescriptive. Now, this necessarily follows from the difference in nature between a directive, which leaves member states fair elements of latitude to implement generally stated objectives, particularly when you are dealing with remedies and enforcement, matters which have by tradition always followed the principle of subsidiarity and have been left to the judgment of each member state. The difference between that and a regulation, and now we have a much higher level of prescription within the regulation. Now, the most reported and talked about example of this is administrative fines, which I'll come to towards the end, where member states are now to be required to apply a uniform system of fines. And with prescription, of course, must come detail. And that's another characteristic that sets the regulation apart from the directive. One example of this is in the provisions on jurisdiction, both as to the respective jurisdictions as supervisory authorities, but also in relation to the jurisdiction of courts, which courts, or rather the courts of which member states, will have jurisdiction when complaints of unlawful processing are made. All of this, of course, is in aid of modernity, something we can't get enough of. Now, no doubt there's been quite a lot this morning, well, I know there's been quite a lot this morning, about the way in which the GDPR attempts to catch up with the case law from the Court of Justice over the last 20 years or so, and also how it attempts to get up to date with the changing nature of the material that contains personal data and that can now be processed. And also, it attempts to future-proof its application, the application of the protections within the regulation in the face of a seemingly unending march of technological change. Now, for our purposes, in relation to remedies and enforcement, modernity means addressing the supranational nature of the way in which data is handled and exploited. We have a regulation rather than a directive precisely because there needs to be EU-wide uniformity in the substantive rules. And from the point of view of remedies, there needs to be clear rules on how jurisdiction to enforce these uniform standards is allocated between the member states, and rules on how authorities of each member state must collaborate with each other. Otherwise, the uniform rules themselves simply will not provide effective protection. Now, the next few slides are about these rules for demarcation of responsibilities between member states and for collaboration between the regulatory authorities. Now, first, supervisory authority, or as we would call the supervisory authority, the Information Commissioner. Here is a summary of the basic requirements and provisions in the regulation. And none of this, well, not much of it, is really going to shock you. One or more per member state, and each is an independent public authority. Obligations of mutual cooperation to promote consistent operation of the GDPR across the EU. That's obviously new, and note it's an obligation rather than a power. There is a power to conduct joint operations with other supervisory authorities. Again, that is a reflection of the, as it were, the cross-border nature of the regime that we will now have. And finally, extraterritorial authority, where there is cross-border processing, and the data controller's establishment or main establishment is in its area, unless the complaint only concerns an establishment in another member state or substantially affects data subjects only in another member state. And so the idea is there's a sort of a home processing or home regulation approach, which is fairly common in many other EU regimes, but here is the application or the realisation of it in the context of the GDPR. Now, the functions of supervisory authorities are set out at length in the regulation. Here is a summary of key points arising from Articles 57 to 59. I'm not going to make you recite them. You have here more detail. You have a more extended list than you find in the directive. But nothing here, I think, that is fundamentally novel or is out of keeping with the functions already exercised by the Information Commissioner, which we have come to know and, of course, love. So we start with promotion of awareness and good practice, receiving and addressing complaints, non-complaint-led compliance investigations, authorising and advisory powers. So those are in relation to codes of practice, certification schemes. There is an obligation to promote them. There is an obligation to enforce them. Investigative powers, both reactive and proactive. There are specified powers of compulsion in relation to, for example, obtaining documents, obtaining information. And the supervisory authorities have what is amusingly called corrective powers, warnings, reprimands, orders for compliance with rights of data subjects, and a general power to give people a good old-fashioned telling off when they need it. So those are the functions. More cross-border stuff. Cross-border incidents. The idea of a lead supervisory authority. Now, which supervisory authority will take the lead when there is a cross-border incident, for want of a better word, and what will be the role of the other relevant supervisory authorities? So put basically, how are they to be required to play sensibly and nicely with each other? Now, the lead authority, as we've already seen from the jurisdiction provisions for supervisory authorities, and will ordinarily be the authority of the establishment, or if an establishment has more than, or if a data controller has more than one establishment, the data controller's main establishment. There are two exceptions to that, where some other supervisory authority will be the lead authority. Firstly, where the data controller has establishments in more than one member state, but the infringement affects only one of those establishments, which is not the data controller's main establishment. The second exception is when the infringement substantially affects data subjects only in a specific member state, which would be different from the member state identified by the usual jurisdictional rule. So that's who the lead supervisory authority is. If there is a dispute as to who is the lead supervisory authority, that is referred to the European Data Protection Board for a binding decision. And if the lead authority takes the case, and I should say the lead authority gets to decide first whether it wants to take the case, it then has to follow a procedure at Article 60, which prescribes various steps which are meant to ensure that supervisory authorities work in a constructive way. So there's an obligation of cooperation on all supervisory authorities in an endeavour to reach consensus as to the outcome of the investigation, an obligation on mutual exchange of information. The lead authority submits the draft decision to other authorities and then takes account of their views. Now, if there is no objection to the decision promulgated by the or circulated by the lead authority, then all supervisory authorities become bound by that decision. And so you have everyone tied into a single decision on an incident that affects people in more than one member state. If there is an objection by one supervisory authority to something that's in the lead supervisory authority's draft report, I almost said that without breathing, then that gets referred to the EDPR, the Data Protection Board, which will come up with a binding resolution on whatever issue it is. So that is the way in which we the regulation seeks to ensure that when you have a cross-border situation, it is dealt with in a uniform, unitary, coherent way. Related to this are separate freestanding obligations, firstly of mutual assistance. As I said earlier, important is an obligation to provide mutual assistance, effectively to the full extent possible, because the only exception, if one supervisory authority is asked by another to do something in aid of the other's investigation, is if the compliance with that request would either be contrary to EU law, probably not going to be arising in many situations, one would hope, or would be contrary to the law of the member state of the supervisory authority that receives the request. Mutual assistance, wide scope, can cover investigations, can be deployed in relation to inspections, exercise of authorisation powers and so on. If there's a dispute, it all goes to the EDPB, which is the body with the biggest stick in terms of the regulatory bodies established under the GDPR. Joint operations, this is something, as it were, beyond enforcement in a formal sense, so joint operations could be proactive as well as reactive. There are various rights of participation for supervisory authorities whose interests are touched on by any proposed action by another supervisory authority. Again, if there are disputes, it's the EDPB that is the tie-breaking or deciding authority. And there are provisions by which one supervisory authority of one state can exercise its powers in another state. So a sort of, you know, diminution of sovereignty type point, subject to safeguards that you see in the last bullet point on the slide. So that is all supervision and so on. Now, European Data Protection Board, I've mentioned it so many times, you must be very, very anxious to know what it is. Well, here it is. It is the overarching European institution in the field, or it will be. It is part cheerleader, it is part watchdog, it is part counsellor to the supervisory authorities of each member state and to the EU Commission, it is part referee, as between supervisory authorities. So perhaps overall, it's just a little bit Frankenstein, but there you are, it does all these things. Membership, top of the slide, one representative from each supervisory authority and a non-voting representative of the Commission to make sure nobody steps out of line, I didn't say that. Functions, there you see them listed. Effectively, it's like a sort of supranational, slightly sort of watered down, sort of, you know, more strategic level version of a supervisory authority. So consistent application of the regulation. There is a, as it were, it is the watchdog for the application of the regulation. It provides assistance to the Commission, advice to the Commission, can prescribe arrangements for how supervisory authorities will exchange information between themselves, and it has the binding dispute resolution powers that I've mentioned in the course of the last couple of slides. Just to add to those, Article 63, you've all been asking about this, the consistency mechanism, who wouldn't want one of those? So, first of all, there's the voluntary bit. Any supervisory authority can request the EDPB to examine or provide an opinion on any matter effectively touching on the application of the regulation. And so effectively the ability to provide advisory opinions on request, and no doubt over time there will be a body of advisory opinions which will have some sort of normative weight behind it, though obviously will not formally be binding on anyone. Secondly, bottom part of the slide, the EDP must provide an opinion when a supervisory authority is considering the exercise of various functions, which I've listed there. They effectively are the generic functions in relation to codes of practice, codes of authorisation and so on. So things that will operate at a national level within the area of that supervisory authority. And the supervisory authority has two choices. It can either accept the opinion or the EDPB can decide whether or not to make its opinion binding. Wonder what we'll do in most cases. So it can either accept the opinion or it can be required to accept the opinion. Those are the options in those circumstances. So the EDPB is the arbiter of last resort on those matters. And as we've seen, on issues going to jurisdiction, as between supervisory authorities, it also has that arbiter of last resort role. So that's enough of the really exciting institutional stuff. Let's go to rights of the data subject, if I can get this slide to move, which I can't. Help. Do I turn it off and turn it on again? Now, is there anyone at the back of the room in that box? Do you have the power to move the slide? It's done. Brilliant. So, rights of data subjects, here we go. That happened to me last week here as well. This has got to be a faulty flipper. Anyway, first of all, rights of access in terms of complaints to supervisory authorities. Well, look, nothing new about that. What you have on the slide, again, is the jurisdictional provisions, which are prescribed in the regulation for the first time. So either you complain to the supervisory authority of your place of residence, your place of work, or the place where the infringement occurred. That's where you go. Rights of access to court. Both in respect of determinations by supervisory authorities and in relation to alleged failures of law in lawful processing by controllers and data processors. Again, you have there the rules relating to jurisdiction. They basically follow, you know, the well-trodden routes when it comes to identifying the appropriate forum. So it's the court, if the court of the member state of residence of the data subject, in the court of the member state where the controller or processor has an establishment. But bear in mind that if you are a data subject and you are exercising rights against a public authority, you must do so in the court of the state where the member, where the public authority is based. So there is no sort of data subject home court option in that scenario. Then we have two bits. First bit, I think, probably more important for our purposes. Rights of representation. So when exercising rights to complain to either supervisory authorities or courts, data subjects may be represented by not-for-profit bodies, organisations or associations, subject to various conditions as to how those organisations are constituted. Now, it seems to me this is potentially very important. It's provision for a form of sort of version of representative action, or a sort of group litigation approach, or if you're a cynical, it's of course a license for international claims farming. But anyway, look, however you see it, it is something that will clearly facilitate bulk claims arising out of major or generic data breaches. It's a better way of holding those concerned to account, given that data claims or individual claims are often not worth the candle if they are pursued by each data subject alone and then balanced against the costs of getting the good legal advice from the likes of you and me. Bottom bit of the slide, if there is a claim in a court in more than one member state, the basic rule is sort of first come, first served. The first court takes jurisdiction, the second court defers to the first court. And in some circumstances, Court 2 can decline jurisdiction. They're set out in the bullet point at the bottom of the slide, assuming, effectively, that the claim could be brought within the court, within the jurisdiction of Court 1. So that's that. Now, compensation. Here we have Article 82, which deals with compensation. Any person who suffers damage by reason of an infringement, underline the word any, has a right to compensation from the controller or processor. And then various points arising from Article 82. Controllers involved in processing are liable for damage caused by processing. Processors are only liable for damage resulting from failures to comply with their obligations, the obligations on processors. There is a defence, although note the reverse burden of proof, if the processor or controller proves that it was not in any way responsible for the event giving rise to the damage. Sounds like an almost existential requirement, but there we go. That clearly is going to be a pretty high burden to overcome for any controller or processor. There is provision for joint and several liability if more than one processor or controller is responsible for the same damage, and then correspondingly, there are rights of contribution as between controllers and processors who are jointly and severally liable. So that's compensation, perhaps not too surprising. Administrative fines. This is the thing that has given everyone the sort of Bateman moment where hair stands on end. Here are the scary provisions, and here they are in full. So firstly, fines may be imposed by supervisory authorities in addition to or instead of their corrective powers. So this is something that sits alongside other enforcement action. The fines imposed are to be effective, proportionate, and dissuasive. Standard EU sort of language. And then there are two categories of fines. There's the lower category for breach of that first clutch of articles, and that for that category, the maximum fine is either, it was the higher of 10 million euros or for an undertaking 2% of worldwide turnover of the preceding financial year. And then there is a, as it were, an upper bracket of fines for breach perhaps of the more significant obligations, particularly those relating to the rights of data subjects. And the upper limit there is the higher of either 20 million euros or 4% of worldwide turnover for the preceding financial year. And then there's a reassuring provision where there are multiple infringements, the fine shall not exceed the amount specified for the gravest infringement. So you can only be, you can be kicked very, very hard, but you can only be kicked once. So that's quite good. Now, precisely how scary are those provisions? Well, let's do a little comparison with where we are now, shall we? So present power is under the Act. Sections 55A to E are the process points, and then under the 2010 regulations. Now, the maximum penalty under the 2010 regulations is £500,000. And here we have, I suspect, an entirely inaccurate, but the best I could do, sort of by basic rudimentary arithmetic, working out where what the quantum of fines has been over the last few years. So 2010, two fines totaling £160,000. 2011, seven fines totaling just over £500,000. 2012, 17 fines totaling £2.1 million. Then the next year, 14 fines, £1.5 million, a good year for data protection, a bad year for data subjects. 2014, nine fines totaling £668,000, particularly law-abiding year there. And then 2015, 18 fines totaling just over 2 million. Now, in this year, until September this year, there were 25 fines totaling 2.5 million. And then in October 2016, TalkTalk got the record of the highest, the largest fine to date, fined £400,000. So, you know, okay, that's the worst so far. Now, what if the new regime had applied to TalkTalk? Seems to me, again, subject to a fallible use of a calculator, that, obviously the fine could have been up to 4% of TalkTalk's turnover for the preceding year. And I think that was about 35 million. And so that would mean the maximum fine could have been about £1.4 million. So you can see there is a, you know, there is clearly a step change in terms of the powers to fine. What, of course, remains to be seen is the extent of the willingness to use those powers to the full extent possible. Will they use the full range of the scale available? A couple more things on fines. Firstly, public authorities and bodies, a derogation from the otherwise mandatory provisions on fines, each member state may determine whether and to what extent administrative fines may be imposed on public authorities and bodies. So the possibility of, as it were, a clemency regime being added into the regulation by domestic provision. And then member states must provide appropriate procedural safeguards attached to the power to impose fines. Well, we're all familiar with that. Seems to me the present provisions under the 2010 Act, sorry, under the Data Protection Act and the 2010 regulations, seem to me that they will be likely to suffice. But anyway, procedural protection is required. Then, in terms of the use of the power, here we have the list in from Article 83. Of matters that supervisory authorities must have due regard when deciding whether to impose a fine, and if so, what the level of the fine should be. So there is no tariff approach. The approach is an evaluative approach. Whether you find that more reassuring or less reassuring depends on your point of view. But here's the list. I won't read it out, but it's all fairly obvious stuff, really, in terms of things that would tend to mitigate and things that would tend to aggravate. I suspect that if you, you know, nailed the information commissioner, when there is one, to the floor, and required the commissioner to tell you, well, what do you take into account? What do you think you take account when you decide whether to impose fines and what to do? You'd probably get a list between the screaming that would be pretty similar to the sort of things you see on this slide. So I say nothing too odd about that. And finally, other penalties. So enforcement isn't enough, damages aren't enough, fines aren't enough. Here we have, as it were, a reversion to a more regular position in terms of the distinction between the regulation and the directive we have, in that there is a permission provided to member states to set their own rules on penalties. There is a clear expectation that each member state will set rules on penalties, so I don't think the no penalty option is likely to be followed through. The penalties are to be effective, proportionate and dissuasive, the same EU boilerplate language. There is no restriction on the nature of the penalty, so the sorts of criminal provisions that we are familiar with in the DPA would be entirely acceptable and no doubt may well be read over or, as it were, transposed into the world of the GDPR. And there is a requirement on member states to notify the provision they have made in respect of penalties to the Commission, no doubt with a view to the Commission taking a view as to whether the penalties are appropriate, whether they are sufficient, and perhaps also with an eye to looking at the level of consistency from member state to member state, with a view to things that might happen next in the wonderful world of data protection. So that's my time almost up. Thank you for your patience.